In May of 1934, 90 years ago now, representatives from a movement of German Christians called the Confessing Church proclaimed the Barman Declaration. This was a statement opposing the false doctrines of the German Christian Church government. Theologian George Hunsinger wrote of the Barman Declaration saying, quote, "Properly understood, Barman lays a foundation for political resistance by the church," end quote. In today's episode, we hear about the story that led to the Barman Declaration, about how Dietrich Bonhoeffer factors into that story, and about how Barman remains relevant today. Keep listening. You are listening to Currents in Religion, a podcast brought to you by the Department of Religion at Baylor University and by Baylor University Press. I'm Zen Hess. Thanks for listening today. To discuss the Barman Declaration, I'm joined by Barry Harvey, who is professor of theology here in the Religion Department, as well as in the Great Text program of the Honors College here at Baylor University. Among other specialties, Barry is a Bonhoeffer scholar, exploring Bonhoeffer's thought in classes, articles, and a book titled Taking Hold of the Real, Dietrich Bonhoeffer and the Profound Worldliness of Christianity. Enjoy this conversation with Barry Harvey about the Barman Declaration. Dr. Harvey, thank you so much for joining us on Currents in Religion.
Thank you so much. Joy to be here.
So in May of 1934, representatives of Lutheran, Reformed, and United Churches from 19 territorial churches gathered and affirmed the Barman Declaration. Could you give us a bit of context for this declaration? What does it say? What was it responding to?
Well, it is a momentous occasion in this month, the 90th anniversary. And it's important to understand that in the background is a group of Christians in Germany who call themselves German Christians. Mm-hmm. And they were pressing for what they ultimately call a synchronization between the National Socialist State, the Führer Adolf Hitler, and the church. Mm-hmm. Indeed, just 6 months before Barman took place, the Barman Conference, a group of them from one of the provincial churches published a statement of principles. And in it, they quite clearly affirm that what they're interested in is a melding together of church and state. So, for example, they talk about the fellowship of the church as a fellowship of blood and destiny of the German people. Germany is our task. Christ is our strength. And then when they referred to the Old Testament, they said it was an example of how God educates a people. And then they say, God has also given us a law to educate our people, and it takes form in the Führer Adolf Hitler and in the nationalist state formed by him. And they went on to say, this law speaks to us in the history of our people, which arises from blood and soil. Blut und Boden is a characteristic Nazi slogan. And they end it with a chant, one people, one God, one Reich, one church. So their activity is in the background, mm-hmm. and they were becoming more and more dominant in the synods of these territorial churches. And indeed, at the end of 1933, in the National Synod, they elected a man by the name of Ludwig Müller as the Reich Bishop, and his mandate was to carry out this synchronization is what they call it. Now, Mueller was politically inept, and he oftentimes made missteps. For example, in early of 1934, he reinstitutes what's called the Arian paragraph, which basically says only pure Arians can be involved in virtually every aspect of society, including the church, and demanded that pastors refrain from public discussion of the church struggle, which they didn't obey. And in addition to that, there was an attempt to annex church youth groups into the Hitler Youth. He proposed that.
Okay.
And again, with a lot of churches, even some who had pro-Nazi sentiments, that was a bridge too far, as it were. And so there was a hubbub. But then in a kind of crafty move, Hitler hosted the leaders of these territorial churches in the chancellery, which is effectively the equivalent of the White House.
Okay.
And made a real big impression on them. And this really, again, brought dissension to the fledgling church, confessing church. And then the man in the Lutheran office is in charge of the English-speaking churches in London, I mean, German-speaking churches in London. If you recall, at this point, Bonhoeffer's not in Germany. He had been effectively forced out of his a position at the University of Berlin. And so he had taken two pastorates in suburban London.
Mm-hmm.
They were German-speaking churches, but he was very much still connected with, constantly interacting with them, coming back at several occasions. The man who was in charge of those German-speaking churches in London was a man by the name of Theodor Herschel. He actually meets up with a very influential English bishop, a man by the name of George Bell, the Bishop of Chichester. And Bell, quite frankly, confronted him on the things that were going on within the church. Herschel tries to soft play it, but Bell wouldn't allow him to do that. And so, obviously, bad blood between the English church, the ecumenical church, the church in Germany. And then also early in 1934, the German government was beginning the process of synchronization with regard to the parochial or provisional governments that had traditionally been independent and autonomous in Germany. Now they were basically just the stooges of the Reich government in Berlin. And so Mueller and some of his associates tried to do the same thing with the church, to synchronize the churches to go along with the national church, the Reich Church. Bonhoeffer appeals. He tries to get help from the fledgling ecumenical movement to unseat the German delegates from the state churches and try to substitute them with the confessing church.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't work. He implored Bell, who he'd become fast friends with, to intervene. Bell sent a letter trying to get the various ecumenical movements to see the danger here. But that, while that didn't have any effect on what was happening in Germany, it did embolden the confessing church leadership. And so in May of, the end of May 1934, there are 139 delegates who meet from the 18 provincial churches and gathered in the village of Barmen to draft what becomes the Barmen Declaration. Karl Barth, the noted Swiss theologian, is the one who drafts the first draft. The delegates work with it. And basically, it confronts the viewpoint of that statement of principles that I read earlier by the German Christians,
mm-hmm.
who wanted to just synchronize church and state, and indeed to make the state another source of revelation.
Right.
And in response, there are 8 affirmations and renunciations in the Barmen Declaration. The most important is the first. It cites 2 passages from the Gospel of John: "I am the way and the truth and the life," and "I am the gate of the sheep fold. No one comes in that I don't allow." And then here's the affirmation. Jesus Christ, as he is attested to us in Holy Scripture, is the one word of God whom we have to hear and whom we have to trust and obey in life and death. And so that is a definitive repudiation of the attempt upon the German Christian movement to meld together church and state in accord with Nazi propaganda.
Mm. So it sounds like there's a lot of context here. You've done a nice job summarizing it. Let's pull on a few threads here. So the big picture in Germany is the consolidation of power that's going on. Mueller is trying to bring kind of the Reich's power into the realm of the church. And you've mentioned some ways that that's being resisted, but overall, that's what's happening. And then beyond Germany, there's an ecumenical kind of movement that Dietrich mm-hmm. Bonhoeffer is trying desperately to kind of bring he's trying to get that group to bring its resources and its influence into the German situation in a way.
Mm-hmm. Trying to get some kind of international pressure
right.
by other Protestant
right,
groups
right.
On the German church.
Right. And so the statement, the Barman Declaration, coming at the time that it does, I mean, the Reich is already underway.
Yes.
But it's responding to a relatively new grab at power by the Reich on the churches.
Well, it's really interesting. My understanding is Hitler wasn't all that interested in the Protestant churches.
Okay.
Save for perhaps if they would present obstacles mm-hmm. to his centralization of power.
Right.
Because ultimately he wanted all power to be in his hands.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so it was these German Christians who were, in essence, lackeys, who wanted to see the church join in this effort.
Okay.
And very much wanting the German evangelical church, again, as a reminder, evangelical in Germany is not what it means in the United States. Evangelical is basically just the Protestant churches, Lutheran, Reformed, and United churches, to be fully on board with the rise to power mm-hmm. and the recovery of Germany of Adolf Hitler. And particularly after the embarrassment and the humiliation of World War I, this was foremost on so many Germans' minds.
Yeah.
That it recover its stature in the world community at that point.
So say just a little bit more, if you could, about you're a Bonhoeffer scholar. Say a little bit more about how you understand Bonhoeffer's role. I mean, you've mentioned that he's kind of he's in London, he's kind of on the outside, but in relation to the Barman Declaration coming to exist, how does Bonhoeffer kind of enable that to happen, or what role does he have in it?
Well, he's very instrumental in the leadership of what becomes the Confessing Church and is constantly exhorting pastors and synod leaders to take an interest in this and to try to show people what was happening. Ultimately, like I said, he did not have a direct hand in its formation, but he was very delighted that resistance to the government's efforts to take over the church,
mm-hmm.
to make it essentially a department of the state, this was an important statement. Now, ultimately, he's not satisfied in part because for him, the most important thing in this whole endeavor was, as he put it, to speak for the voiceless,
yeah.
those who were being persecuted. And he specifically has Jews in mind.
Right.
And that comes out very much later on when he is involved in the attempt to formulate a more fulsome confession called the Bethel Confession that originally had explicit statements to this effect about pleading for those who could not plead for themselves, who had mm-hmm. no voice, who were being persecuted. But it was left out of the final draft, and so he didn't sign that.
Okay.
And he was constantly trying to emphasize that point. And in his later writings, constantly comes back to that. He says, if you expel Jews from Germany, you expel Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, that's kind of, you know, he helped in the formation of the Confessing Church leadership. When he returns to Germany, he becomes the leader of one of the illegal seminaries that were set up to train ministers, since the Confessing Church leadership believed that the universities could no longer be trusted to train ministers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And say a little bit more about his criticisms of the Barman Declaration. I'm aware that others since, including Bart, I think, ended up having some regrets about what the document did say. So in as much as it was a radical statement of allegiance to Jesus, you've mentioned here that it doesn't make any real explicit reference to the mistreatment of Jews in Germany. Were there other qualms that Bonhoeffer had with the document?
Yeah, initially, interestingly enough, even though the document itself is couched very much in Lutheran terms, a lot of Lutheran leadership in the country thought it was far too reformed. You have to remember, Lutherans have a tradition of being required by God to obey the secular ruler.
Right.
And made very uneasy about any statement about that. And mm-hmm. so it really doesn't even question a kind of loyalty to Germany.
Right.
That's part of it as well. It was considered radical at the time because even though, for example, Anabaptists had spoken to these kinds of issues, I'm thinking specifically of the Schleitheim Confession, for territorial churches, magisterial churches, to take up this line was pretty radical for its time.
Right.
But it was also somewhat restrained. And it tried to emphasize the state has no role in the church, but the church has no business beyond its own responsibility to preach the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
And it was written that way to help Lutherans try to tie onto it.
Yeah.
Ultimately, it didn't confess a whole lot of people, but the confessing church did get an impetus from it. And began to develop, and particularly later on in the 30s, this is when they, you know, the legal seminaries are being trained and the like. And it was a bold move because it was a schismatic move.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting to think about the affirmation and renunciation that's specifically about the kind of separation of church and governance. I know that Reformed traditions, they like Lutherans have a default position of we have a biblical command, a biblical mandate to honor the governing authorities. But within the Reformed tradition, it seems like there's maybe a more substantial qualification that says if these governing authorities are deliberately disobeying the word of God, there is a freedom to kind of for a time resist or, to not look at them as authorities, as being out of step with God's calling or purpose for them, whatever that might be. And in the Barman Declaration, it's very unclear whether that caveat is there, which leaves it, I think, open to some criticism there.
It does. And again, these people were trying to herd a bunch of cats, as it were. You know, they're trying to hold together the Reformed United Churches, which were more ready to take it a bit further than what they did.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't speak out for the Jews. It doesn't criticize the Arian paragraph, which initially removed any pastor from any church leadership that had any Jewish heritage.
Including some of Bonhoeffer's dear friends, yeah?
Dear friends and his brother-in-law.
Right, and his brother-in-law, yeah.
Who ultimately they escaped to London before the war began. His sister, his twin sister and her husband, who was part Jewish. And so there, you don't get that.
Right.
Now, let me say that for its time, it does take a bold, radical step.
Yeah.
And it is very interesting. Just in the last couple of years, a group of Eastern Orthodox scholars and clergy have issued what they called a declaration on the Russian world teaching, Russian world in Russian's Ruski Mir. And it's patterned after the Barman.
Oh, fascinating.
I can't swear to that because I haven't found any of the original draftees who wrote it, but it has the same kind of preamble and then six affirmations and six denunciations, just like in the Barman.
Yeah.
And for each of them, it introduces it with the biblical passage.
Oh, fascinating.
And so you can tell Barman still has reverberations to this day.
Yeah.
Now, the declaration on this Russian world teaching by these Orthodox scholars and clergy actually go much further.
Sure.
And condemn any attempt to associate the kingdom of God and the work of the church with any particular people.
Mm-hmm.
This has been, and Orthodox will tell you this, particularly in this country, a kind of recurring problem because Orthodox have had this dubious notion called ethnophilitism, in which God's work is associated with a particular people.
Yeah.
And so the Patriarch of Moscow, Kirill, has played on this a good bit, that Russia occupies a special place in God's providence. But other churches there has done that as well. And then there's also an interesting notion that the church and the government, the ruler, engage in what they call symphonia, a symphony or a cooperation very closely. And you see that even in people like Dostoevsky. And so, in Russia, when they talk about Mother Church or Mother Russia, they're talking about Russia as having a divine purpose in God's overall economy.
Hmm.
So this statement actually goes a lot further than Barman does in condemning that.
Yeah. You are listening to Currents in Religion, and I'm speaking with Barry Harvey about the Barman Declaration after 90 years. Before we return to our conversation, here's a quick chat I had with the folks at Baylor Press about a book I think you might find interesting. I'm here with Cade Jarrell, one of the editors at Baylor University Press. Cade, what do you have for us today?
Yeah, so this is a really exciting one, especially, as we at Baylor University Press represent the larger university of Baylor. So Todd Rehm and Jerry Pattingill with the Anxious Middle, they are at the forefront of a coalition to revitalize Christian higher education. And this book is the forerunner of that larger project that's actually funded by the Lilly Grant. So they're utilizing Bonhoeffer primarily to explain the situation that our schools find themselves in, and they ground the situation in possibility and hope. What's really cool about this particular book is that the postscripts are written by several presidents of Christian universities and colleges, including Linda Livingstone of Baylor University. So it's very much geared towards those in positions to make these changes. It's very practical. It's laying out paradigms for how Christian colleges and universities can chart new paths for higher education and remain committed to a faithful witness in the midst of a tumultuous time for faith. So it is an academic book, but at the same time, it is a book for folks on committees. It's for donors and regents. This is really exciting because this is, again, part of a much larger project that we're excited to see develop.
Awesome. Thanks, Cade.
Yep.
tell me a little bit about the fallout from the Barman Declaration? I mean, they gathered, they got a number of representatives together and signed this statement, which you've called in a couple of different cases a bold move or a bold step.
Mm-hmm.
What was the response in Germany?
Well, by and large, Germans were, well, first of all, they were, most of them were just very patriotic.
Yeah.
And so you have that. And also, they had suffered through the humiliation of World War I and its aftermath.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was already a kind of inertia there.
Sure. Okay.
Now, you did have churches and synods who aligned themselves with the Confessing Church.
Right.
But for the most part, they tended to stick to their church knitting, as it were, and therefore not press too much on the larger social issues. And this is why, once the war begins, a lot of the people in the Confessing Church went into the army,
right,
to defend the fatherland.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can see there that, again, a lot of ambiguity.
Right.
You mentioned Eberhard Bethke earlier, I believe, or if you hadn't, I'll mention him now. Eberhard Bethke was a good friend of Bonhoeffer, was a conservator of his estate. We have all the writings of Bonhoeffer because Bethke gathered them together. He, too, served in the army. And so we see this impetus. And so he writes what is, in fact, a magisterial 1,000-page biography of Bonhoeffer. But when it first came out in the 60s, he was defending Bonhoeffer and the other conspirators in the attempt to take over the German government and get rid of Adolf Hitler to the German people. Because in spite of their hatred of Hitler, they were traitors.
Right.
Subsequently, as succeeding generations came along in Germany, they were seen instead as national heroes, Bonhoeffer and the people that he associated with in the conspiracy, a push, as it's called in German, to overthrow the German government.
Mm.
And of course, there was the controversial element of ultimately regicide of the assassination of Hitler.
Right.
And there's a lot of debate about exactly what Bonhoeffer thought about that, but he still cooperated with him. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, it's interesting. He decides he doesn't want to be in the army. He can't be in the army. He'd already written in the book Discipleship that he was a pacifist. But he also thought he had to be in Germany and go through it.
Right.
He had an opportunity to sit out the war in the United States. He didn't take it. He was here a few months, and then he just went back.
Mm-hmm.
So his brother-in-law was, another of his brother-in-laws, was a member of the military intelligence office. And so he was signed up as an unpaid worker, agent of the Abwehr, the military intelligence office, which did two things for him. It kept him out of the army and allowed him to travel around Europe to neutral countries.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those trips was in 1943. He went to Sweden, and there he met with George Beall, trying to create a relationship between the conspiracy and the Allied government. It didn't go anywhere, but that's what ultimately doomed any attempt on the part of the Confessing Church,
right.
The conspiracy. To effect a real relationship.
Yeah.
Churchill in particular was very opposed to seeing any German as a good German.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, that's what happens in war. You have to demonize your opponent.
Mm. So that's kind of the long view of how things unfolded. Is there any evidence that Hitler picked up on the Barman Declaration and was responding to? I know you'd said that he was kind of ambivalent towards the churches unless they were an obstacle. Did he see this statement as an obstacle?
There's no indication that he did.
Okay.
And again, the security apparatus, the Gestapo and the like within the country would take care of all that kind of opposition.
Yeah, right.
And the Confessing Church did encounter some of that.
Yeah.
The illegal seminary
right.
that, for which Bonhoeffer is the principal was closed down by the Gestapo.
Mm-hmm.
And to try to plug in the gap, he started mentoring individual pastors,
mm-hmm.
writing letters, writing a newsletter to kind of help people
right.
out along in that
right.
regard.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there is opposition.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Hitler was uninterested in those kinds of matters.
Sure.
As a matter of fact, from what I've read, the only interest Hitler had in his own Catholic Church is that the Holy Roman Empire had lasted
mm-hmm.
for as long as it did, and he wanted his 1,000-year Reich to last as yeah. long as that. So,
yeah. What would you say the American Church has to learn from the Barman Declaration today?
Well, we face a very polarized and fragmented population, and there is a significant portion of the American populace who is very much attracted to this kind of America as God's chosen people,
mm-hmm.
last best hope. And this is expressed, among other things, in the Dominion theology movement, but most well-known right now is the White Christian Nationalist movement.
Mm-hmm.
They're saying a lot of things that echo very strongly and disturbingly, from my perspective, of what the German Christians were saying as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of idolization of the leader,
sure.
Hitler in Germany, and we know the person who's idolized in much that same way in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, there's a lot of overlap there. I mean, there are important differences as well. Again, circumstances. The people who are drawn toward this movement think that America has no longer respected, no longer what it was, and they're longing to regain that prominent place in America,
mm-hmm.
make America great again.
Right.
Very similar to the kinds of motivations that were going on in the late 20s and 30s in Germany
mm-hmm.
for that kind of revitalization
yeah.
of the nation.
Well, so it remains relevant.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Very much so.
Yeah. Dr. Harvey, thank you so much for making time to talk with us today about the Barman Declaration.
Sure enough.
I hope you liked this conversation with Barry Harvey. If you enjoyed it, share it with someone who might like it too. And if this is your first time listening to Currents, why don't you have a look through our archives? I bet there are a number of other episodes you might like. If you haven't subscribed already, please do so you don't miss future episodes. And if you feel comfortable doing so, I'd invite you to leave a review. That will help us know how we're doing, and it'll help others find out about this podcast. Friends, this is the last episode of our spring season, so you won't hear anything from us for a while. But don't fret, we'll be back in midsummer with another summer school season. Until then, take care, friends.